I don't know that it's necessary at all, but I say so in case some of you don't know me. I want to know you if we are not now friends and acquaintances. My name's Tom Lovern, and I am an alcoholic. And by the grace of God, and the help of hundreds of people like you, and as a partaker of the greatest of all blessings God's ever given to an alcoholic, I'm privileged to be a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have known our speaker for a number of years. Some years ago, I had the privilege of being with him on the platform in a program in Washington, D.C. And we talked tonight at dinner. And he said, before I could say it, what I wanted to say to him. He said, I remember the first few moments that we met together, and I fell in love with him. I met him some years later, and not too long ago, over at Amarillo, Texas, and we talked about Blackstone. And we have been trying to make paths cross and arrangements fit so that we could have him come with his lovely wife, Elsa, whom you enjoyed so much today, that they might both share the richness of their lives with us. And I think it's a great privilege and an honor that is ours. Not because he is Chuck Chamberlain, but because he too has been so richly blessed in this God-given fellowship. And any time I find a man so blessed, I know he has something that can add to my blessing. And I anticipate this hour, even as you do. Chuck said a funny little thing today, being humorous. He said after this beautiful program the women did for us this morning, he said, you know something? Elsa has about put me out of the local scene. And my youngest son, Richard, has put me out of the international picture. And I am now practically a nobody. And I present to you, I think, the most glorious nobody I have ever known, Chuck Chamberlain.
Thank you, Tom. I think you should have said, however, Colonel Nobody. I am Chuck C., and I'm an alcoholic. I think I would be remiss if I didn't start out thanking Tom and Dutch and whoever else might have had anything to do with having Mr. C and I here. So far, this has been a fabulous experience. I could do without this part of it, all right, myself. But I have been repaid already many times for coming, and I am indeed grateful to you all for allowing us to be with you. Tom and his good wife have been very meaningful to me for a long time. And on this trip, I've added Dutch and his good wife. And I feel most blessed that I've been able to know them a little better. And I've added them to the first layer in my heart. There are many here who are more meaningful to me than I am. And if any of you should happen to get the idea before I sit down that I love this program and that I love its people, you're right. Seems the longer I'm around you, the more completely I become wrapped up in the peoples of our program. All things are good with us now. Everything that I know of in the area of our livingness is good. And yet I find myself no more completely and totally dependent today than I have ever been in my lifetime. I find myself more in need of you, the peoples of Alcoholics Anonymous, in this program and my God, than I have ever been. More even than 17 years ago when I came. Because, you know, when things are good with it, there is the great temptation to subconsciously or consciously reach for the wheel again, to become a little bit important to ourselves. And I find it much, much more necessary now that I spend my time in surrender than in the very beginning. Because in the beginning, if it had just been possible for me to die and have it over with, I would have been very grateful indeed. But now, I want to live. And it's more necessary that I remember why I am alive and from whence came this gift of life to me than it ever was before. Now my dependence is not a dependence of fear. From the time I woke up to the fact that I was sober, 16 and a half years ago, 6 months after I got here, when I woke up to the fact that I was sober and had been from the very moment of surrender, from that time on, I haven't been afraid of anything. I haven't been afraid of me or you or life or death or God or the devil, or things present or things to come. And so this is not a dependence of fear. It's a dependence of absolute certainty that it's my business to walk in this way, and it's God's business to take care of. And that's the way I live. That's the only way I know how to live. I can't run my life. I can't run my business. And as many of you probably noticed this afternoon, I can't run my wife. Ha, 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 ha. so it's quite wonderful to know that you don't have to. So again, it's a great joy for me to share this evening with you. And I'd like to just say a few little things before I get lost, which I probably will in a little while. A few little observations. You know, it makes very little difference what happens to you and me in this life. It is our reaction to what happens to us that makes it difference. This is a great thing to learn. It's not what happens, it's our reaction to what happens that makes it difference. Another little thing. That is very meaningful to me is that I am convinced now that people don't act like they act because they want to, but because they have to. And when you know that people don't act like they act because they want to, but because they have to, they can't hurt you. You see, we alcoholics are inclined to think that we have a corner on obsessions of the mind. You know, we got obsessions of the mind. But we don't give you all the, you normal people, you citizens. We don't very easily give you the right to have obsessions of the mind. But to come to see that this is true, and that people act like they act because they have to. I am convinced tonight that every person in the world is doing the best he can according to his light. That is according to his understanding. Every one of us doing the best we can according to our light. That is according to our understanding. And when we know this, it frees us up considerably. And we are not then dependent on the actions of others, but we are dependent only on our own reaction. It's a very freeing thing. Now, another little remark I'd like to make is that insofar as I am able to see, there is not one answer for me, an alcoholic, and another answer for you, a non-alcoholic. I believe that there is one answer, and it's just the same for me as it is for you, and for you as it is for me. It so happens that I can take no credit for having found that answer, because if it had been humanly possible for me to remain in left field, I would still be out there. I can't even take credit for deciding to come here, because I couldn't come until after I had lost the power of decision or choice. My choice was never to come here. The idea of me coming to a bunch of drunks for help was obnoxious to me, to say the least. And yet I find many of you who didn't have my propulsion. Choosing this way of life and finding the same answers that we find. And it's a very wonderful thing, and I most certainly want to express my gratitude and love for the program of Al-Anon. I think in many ways they're doing more with our program than many of us. Because in many instances we come here looking for sobriety and get sober and think we have it made. And when we get rid of the bottle, we forget then that we have to get rid of ourselves and our problems, personal problems, in order to stay rid of the bottle. And we don't do the things that the program suggests that allow us to live in sobriety. And the Al-Anon comes here without the necessity of the bottle or the excuse of the bottle. And immediately, they start doing the things that you and I are supposed to do to clean up themselves. And they do a whale of a job with it. And in many areas, they're doing a better job than we are. And so I salute them. And lastly, I believe in every man's religion for him, and nobody's religion but my very own for myself. And I have to call them as I see them. I am pretty sure that when one has found himself and his brother and his God, that he can see that all ways are good. But no particular way is necessary. All ways are good, but no particular way is necessary. Now, I am not a priest or a preacher or a rabbi, and I am not frustrated by that fact. I am not a doctor or a psychiatrist, and I am not frustrated by that fact. I am an alcoholic, and I am no longer frustrated by that fact. That's the way it is with me. I am an alcoholic. And I have found my own peace in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I love it, and I admit prejudice. But you see, Alcoholics Anonymous is not the thing. It also is a way. This is the way, not the thing. And we must never get it in our head that Alcoholics Anonymous is the thing. Some of these days there might not even be an Alcoholics Anonymous. Now there's a little poem that I love very, very much. It's a verse in In Memoriam, I believe. It says, Earth, earth, little systems have their day. They have their day and cease to be. They are but broken lights of thee, but thou, O God, are more than they. And so it is that it is not the system. And it is not an individual in the system or out of it that brings about this change. It's the individual fulfilling the conditions of the system. Now today, Alcoholics Anonymous is the finest system that has ever been created for the likes of me. But nobody can fulfill its conditions for me but myself. Now we might look at ourselves a little bit and say to ourselves, who might be subject to the disease of alcoholism? Would it be just those who are physically weak? And I've looked around a great deal since I've been here. And I think there are more big men physically in this group than any like number I've ever seen. There's some of the biggest men around here I've saw. And some of them look pretty tough. But you know, the whole bunch of us combined can't handle 1 ounce of alcohol. I have a friend at home that not too many years back was an All-American football player, USC. And right now you take hold of a man's arm and it's like taking hold of a steel post. He can't handle one. I'll go on. We have world champions in here, and they can't handle an ounce of alcohol. So we would have to say to ourselves very quickly, it's not just those who are physically weak. And then we might say to ourselves, well, would it be just those who are mentally weak? And we'd have to quick rule that out, because we're here, aren't we? But besides us, you know, there are some pretty smart cookies in this fellowship. Doctors, lawyers, professors, big people in the world of business. I was dragging a meeting here just the other night at home, and the guy that was leading the meeting had a Phi Beta Kappa bee hanging on. And he had PhD after his name. And he's a professor in one of our local universities. And he is recognized as a world scholar. And he was leading the meeting not by proxy. He belongs here. So we'd have to say, no, it wouldn't be just those who are mentally weak. And then we might say to ourselves, well, it would would it just be those who are entirely without spiritual or religious background? And we'd have to quick rule that out. I think there is not a like number of people in any segment of human society as we have in Alcoholics Anonymous that would contain so many sons and daughters of preachers. Men and women who have studied for the priesthood or the ministry, or priests and ministers, as our society has. The woods is just full of them, present company excepted. So we couldn't say that it's just those who are without a religious or spiritual understanding of any kind. And then we'd have to say to ourselves, well, does alcohol alone cause alcoholism? And we'd have to quickly rule that out. Because, you see, there are thousands of good Saturday night drunks who are not alcoholic at all. Those who seem to know tell me that not more than 10% of those on the skid rows of our country are alcoholics. They're just good old Saturday night drunks. I have had drinking partners who could get just as drunk as I did, and who did things that I never did, like coming home and cleaning out the house, you know, beating their wives up, their kids. I never did that in my life. It was the other way around in my family. I know a lot of you alcoholic men sort of mooning over that pudding thing that was up here this afternoon and made that talk, you know. Let me tell you something. She used to beat me till the arms were black to the elbows. And I never hit her in my life. Why, I'll never know. God knows she needed it. But I've known many who could clean out the house and wake up the next morning, shake their head, and say, oh, I got drunk last night, didn't I? They go ahead about their business, and they don't get any worse and they don't get any better. They are not alcoholics. So we'd have to rule out the fact that alcohol alone causes alcoholism. Because if alcohol alone caused alcoholism, every excessive drinker would be an alcoholic. But this is not the case. So we'd pretty nearly have to conclude that alcohol plus a spiritual, mental, and physical complex that is right for it causes alcoholism. It is alcohol alone that causes alcoholism. Now, I am an alcoholic. I cannot live and drink. And of myself, I can't keep from drinking. Why am I not drunk tonight? I'm 3,000 miles away from home. And it's Saturday. I have the thing that I was looking for in the bottle. I've got the thing. Now, what is the thing? It's a state of being. It's a state of being. There is nothing that a drink of liquor or a sedating or tranquilizing pill could do for me but tear me down. And therefore, there is no need to drink. The need is gone. Why was I drunk 20 years ago tonight? I'm sure I was. Because of a state of being. Because of a state of being. A state of being that was so lousy that I had to get drunk in order to get rid of the hurt. So, I am sober because of a state of being. And I was drunk because of a state of being. I had to drink. To get rid of me. To get rid of that hurt. And as bad as was the physical torture, and as bad as was the mental anguish, there was a hurt that far exceeded them both. And that was the hurt in the very middle of my being. That came from the sickness of the soul. The knowledge that I was losing the battle of life. The knowledge that people whom to me were most certainly not my equal in ability, they were passing me up on the high road of life. And I didn't know why. And I hurt. And I had no answers for me, and I hurt. And I had to get drunk. Now something has happened, and that's what we're going to talk about tonight. That's what we're going to talk about, the problem and the answer, as I see it. Alcohol was no problem to me when I found it. It was an answer. I have 17 years and 2.5 months to look back over without one conscious desire to drink. 17 years and 2.5 months. Not one conscious desire to drink in all that time. 25 years of drinking. And the time before that. And in looking over it, I see that I was forever a rebel. I was born that way. And when I found alcohol, it was no problem. I already was my problem. And alcohol was my answer. And it was an answer for a long time.
It wasn't any problem. I got drunk when I wanted to. And when I didn't want to, I didn't get drunk. But it did something for me that was very wonderful, something that I needed to have done. It allowed me, number one, to live in my own world. And number two, it took the hurt out of the world around me. Because of my very nature, I was a misfit. And I couldn't integrate myself into the life around me. Because I didn't like it. And when I had a few drinks, it made it possible for me to live with you without hurting too bad. And for 15 years, I drank that way. And alcohol was not the problem, it was the answer. And after 15 years of drinking, the answer became the problem. Because, you see, it wasn't the right answer in the first place. And it became the problem, and I didn't then know why. All of a sudden, I was not drinking according to my pattern. And I had a pattern for everything. I did everything according to a code. And I had a code for drinking. And all of a sudden, I'm not drinking according to my code, and I don't know why. But thinking it's a personal weakness, a weakness in me, that I had to overcome, I started working on that weakness, that problem. And I worked on it for the next 10 years. And the harder I worked, the worse it got. And the worse it got, the harder I worked. Now, I did not think that total abstinence was the way out. Any weakling could quit drinking. But it took a pretty good boy to beat it in its own game. And I set about to beat it. And I was still saying for 2 years after everybody quit listening to me, I'll beat this thing. It was the last thing I ever do. And it came that close to being the last thing I ever did. I believe I'm safe in saying that in the last 5 years of my drinking, 90% of my waking time was spent on the problem. Yeah. I had to win. I became a periodic when I discovered that I was in trouble. Just because I had to win. And you can't fight a very good battle when you're down on your back. And so I had to get sober and get well and get strong in order to get back in the ring. I had lost a round, but I wasn't going to lose the fight. I had a great system. I ate well and slept well and drank milk and ate vitamins and exercised. And in the latter years, I added psychology and religion. Ha! I prepared on three fronts. And when I had done all my analyzing and I knew where I'd made my mistakes and had decided not to do it that way anymore,
I would then start sampling very delicately and sample myself right on back to bed again. Now, in those last years, I tried to find an answer. I went to men of the cloth. I went to doctors and people that know more psychiatry than there was. Really. And they couldn't help me because they didn't know the nature of my problem. Every one of them talked to me about willpower, backbone, standing up and being a man. And I was sure there was nothing wrong with my willpower or my backbone or the standing up and being a man department. I had made my own way since I was 13. And I'd been quite an athlete in my day, and I'd done pretty good until I got lost in alcohol. And I was rather proud of my backbone. It had never bothered me. My willpower was par excellence. I could get liquor in Kansas on election day if it fell on Sunday. And it depended only on how high I was bouncing, how long it took. If I was well up off the sidewalk, just a few minutes, and I could have it jug in any town in the United States. So my willpower was all right. My won't power might have been just a little deficient. I don't know. And in the standing up and being a man department, I'd have given them cards and spades. See, I'd been a system man for years. I was hunting something, and I hunted every place. I thought one of the systems, or one of the proponents of one of the systems, would do this thing for me. And I went through them one after another. When I'd go through a system and didn't have the answer, I'd get me another system. And I became very proficient in the systems. I was the guy that explained Catholicism to the Catholics, Judaism to the Jews, and Mohammedism to the Mohammedans. I wasn't known as a drunken deacon for 10 years for nothing. I'll tell you that. And I didn't think there was anything wrong with the standing up and being a man department. So I could get no help from them. And I couldn't help myself because I didn't know the nature of my problem. And I had to run out of everything. I had to run out of people, places, things, health, sanity, money, and liquor all at once. And when there was no place else to go, I came here and found out what was wrong with me in the first place. You people told me why I couldn't drink like other people, and this is a thing that's been driving me nuts for years. People whom I recognized as my inferiors, both mentally and physically, and spiritually, if you will,
could drink that stuff and didn't bother. And I was always getting in trouble. And they were telling me, Chuck, you can't drink. You got to quit. And I'd say to me, why can't I drink? He does. The bib squeak. And my answer to me was, you can and you got to prove it. And there I was trying to prove it for 10 years after the law and not knowing that no one had ever won the battle. But I came here and you told me why. Why can't I drink successfully? Because I'm an alcoholic. What is an alcoholic? A person who suffers with the disease of alcoholism. I never heard that word until I got here. In my day, they didn't know. Thank God many preachers, priests, doctors, psychiatrists, and lay people know the nature of our problem now, and they can tell us and tell us where we can go for help. But in my day, this was not true. So I had to drink the last dregs out of the bottom of the cup and come here, and you told me. And I have remained to find that, medically speaking, alcoholism is the third worst killer in the country today, topped only by heart and cancer. And incidentally, running around this country, in Canada as I have in the last 10 years, I have talked with many doctors who have researched this thing for years. And they say that it is their private opinion that if the brain explosions and heart failures that should be attributed to alcoholism were, right now, it would be number one as a killer in the United States. I just bring that point and I don't think it's important. Whether we're first or third, we get show money anyhow, don't we? To one of our social diseases is a cause for permanent insanity. And medically speaking, it's incurable, and that's what I got. I'm an alcoholic. It's pretty rough. It's a very, very serious deal. It's a matter of life and death. And that's what I got. I'm an alcoholic. Now, medically, they define the disease as a disease of a twofold nature. An allergy of the body coupled with an obsession of the mind. It's both mental and physical. An allergy of the body, physical. Obsession of the mind, mental. The reason I can't drink like the normal drinker is because I'm not like him. I'm different, both mentally and physically. Now, this is a good thing to know. I never knew this till you people told me. It's a good thing to know. The allergy of the body means simply this, that my body cannot successfully handle alcohol. I can't oxidize it, burn it up, and get rid of it. When I take a slug of liquor, one slug, I retain it. It goes into the bloodstream of the brain. And it triggers a physical demand that makes me keep on drinking until my cycle is run. This is not true with over 90% of those who drink liquor. It's only true of people like me. I'm different. Now don't ask yourself what that physical difference is. Because there isn't a doctor on earth that knows. Even after 35 years of research, there's not a one in the world that knows. I read some funny ones. Some doc down here in Texas came out here last summer, I think it was, with the great and profound conclusion that if we just drink lots of sauerkraut juice, we'd be in like Flynn. That is pure alcoholism, sauerkraut juice. Well, I drank enough sauerkraut juice trying to get over a hangover to float this building on down to the Pacific Ocean. It never even cured a hangover. Don't spend spend any time on what the physical difference is. You either got it or you ain't. Nobody knows, so we don't spend any time on that. But the things we do need to spend some time on. Number one, once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. Now I say that in face of the fact that I read the Harper's Magazine article. I read it. And they mentioned something that might be a little different from that statement, but I didn't see it. I haven't seen anybody yet. All that I have seen who were alcoholics, who tried to become unalcoholic, came unglued. So from my experience over 17 years, I say once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. That's very important to us because it's so easy after one gets physically sober and get the wrinkles out of their tummy and a little money in their pockets to think, well, I've built me up some good drinking time. You know? There's no such thing as the likes of me building up any good drinking time. Now, there's another thing that you and I must keep forever uppermost in our consciousness. And that is the physical side of the disease gets worse with the passage of time, even when we ain't doing it. This is the only disease I've ever known that gets worse when you ain't doing it. But even during long, extended periods of total abstinence, we get less able to react normally to alcohol. I am 15 years worse off, so far as successfully drinking is concerned, than I was when I crawled in here. And I know it. Because I have been active in this program for 17 years. And when you're active, you can't forget it because your friends are forever proving it for you. One of the greatest arguments in favor of staying close to and active in this program is just this. You can never forget it. That the physical part of the disease gets worse with the passage of time. When you're active. The worst heartbreak that we ever have to go through is to sit in a dark room with that man or that woman who's had up to 20 years, who forgot. It's a heartbreak. But it never lets you forget that the physical part of the disease gets worse with the passage of time. Many of you have heard tapes and some of you have heard the man that came to this program with me January 1946. And for 15 straight years, did a wonderful job in our program. Probably the finest speaker that ever came out of our part of the country. Dear man. 2 years ago, Christmas, he got messing with that stuff again for some reason. He didn't last 2 months. We had to bury him within 2 months after 15 straight years of total absence. And so it is that we've had to watch a few of them die. But we're not concerned with trying to try ourselves out to see if we're more allergic than we were 17 years ago when you go through a few of those. Now, lastly, there's no cure for the body. If we had all the money in the state, it wouldn't be enough to send me someplace and get a cure for my body. There is no such cure. So what are we going to do about it? We are going to accept the fact, I am, that I am physically different, that I don't have any more good drinking time left and never will, and there is nothing I can do about it, period. Now, if seeing this, we could decide to quit drinking and quit, we wouldn't have a problem in the world. It's a simple thing for an alcoholic to see that first slug that starts the drunk, after it's explained to us. I could see it so quickly when they told me. It never occurred to me it was the first slug. I thought it was the last gallon. And that's what I was working on, to cut it off before the trouble started. But when you people told me it was the first slug that started the drunk, not that I got drunk every time I took a drink, because I didn't. I was cute. I was real cute. But it means that when we take a drink, we get drunk before we quit taking a drink. That's all it means. And if seeing this, we could decide to quit and quit, we wouldn't have a problem, because it's so easy to see. But this is impossible. Why? Because the other half of the disease, the obsessions of the mind that cause us to drink. You see, there's no physical demand for liquor when the body's dry. Otherwise, I'd be in bad shape tonight. But I don't hurt anybody. The first drink is mental. The second drink and the 542nd drink are physical, but the first one is mental. And if you and I, being alcoholic, want to get rid of the bottle, we must be rid of the mental obsessions that cause us to drink. It's just as silly for an alcoholic to decide to quit drinking as it is for a tubercular to decide to quit coughing. Tuberculars, to be rid of the coffee, has got to be rid of the disease. And if I'm to be rid of the bottle, I must be rid of the mental obsessions that cause me to drink. You see, that's the reason you never hear anything about willpower here. Because we know that the obsessions of the mind are greater than the willpower. We read a little spa out there in our country for lady alcoholics. It's a sort of detention place. They keep you in there without your permission, you know. Penal in nature. And they don't get liquor in there very easy. You know, they don't get much liquor in there. And here about 3 or 4 weeks ago, a bunch of these gals found some lacquer thinner. Pretty high percentage of alcohol. And they decided it was time. They forgot to run it through the loaf of bread. But they did take precautions. They mixed it with milk. Remember when you used to use a half cup of cream before you went out to drink? Then you even got so you ate a half a pound of butter. And then you changed the olive oil. Because somebody said it, you wouldn't, you know. So they took the precaution of putting it in milk and orange juice. And they got quite a buzz on for a little while. But 27 of them went to the hospital and 2 of them died.
mental obsessions. We got to be rid of them.
And how are we going to do it? Well, the book says that we got to get a little help from the power greater than itself. Lack of power was our dilemma, says the book. And if we don't have the power, we got to find one. And it's obvious that it's got to be a power greater than itself. This I believe as I believe I'm here. For just a simple reason. If I could have stayed sober, I wouldn't believe it. I could not stay sober, therefore believe it. I lacked the power. Where was the power when I was waking up in jail? There I was. I lacked the power. Where was the power when I was writhing in the floor, chewing my tongue full of holes and babbling like an idiot in an alcoholic fit? Uh-oh, there's a retreat. Alcoholic convulsion. Sounds better. As far as I'm concerned, it's a fit. Just the same. I lacked power. I had it. I had a lot of it. Where was power when between drunks, when I was just physically as sober as I am right now? And I was between every two drugs in the last 10 years. I was physically sober as I am right now. Where was the power when I get the idea going home one night, it's been quite a little while since you had been. You're going home to eat. Anybody knows one drink won't hurt if you're going to eat. Why don't you drop into Joe's and get a double? Where was the power? I dropped into Joe's and never did get home. I lacked the power. And so I agree with the book that under certain conditions, certain circumstances, it seems there's only one defense against that first slug. And that is help from a power greater than ourselves. Now how are we going to get it? We got a formula. We got a formula that's foolproof. All we got to do is fulfill the conditions. The first condition is back in chapter 3. It says we learned we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. We have to identify with the disease of alcoholism first. Physically and mentally, both physically and mentally. We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. In the preamble it says, if you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. Second condition. And the last line before the 12 steps says, here are the steps we took. We're sober. Here are the steps we took. And then it lists 12 steps. And all you and I have to do is to do the things that it tells us to do. And something happens, and we don't have to drink anymore. There is a miracle here. There is a miracle here. And we don't bring it about. But we do the things that allow it to happen. And they're listed, and they're just as simple as they can be, and there's not a big word in them. And all we got to do is do it. Now y'all know the steps as well as I do. I like to talk about them, but I'm not going to get through now until about 12:15. I love
lot of them, and I'd like to talk about all of them. I'd like to talk about the 12 traditions, because all of these are a very integral part of me. My program has 24 steps in it, both the steps and the traditions, and love to talk about it. But we haven't time. All we got to do is to get simple enough to do the things that the steps tell us to do, as honestly as we know how, to the best of our ability, one day at a time, and the power is added. Something happens. Something happens. You see, the first third of the 12th step says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. Don't say maybe. It don't say these steps and a lot of other things. It says having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. And all we need to do is do it as honestly as we know how, one day at a time, and something happens. The power is at it. We don't have to drink anymore. Now, it'd be wonderful if I could stand up here and say to you, all you got to do is listen me out tonight, and you'll get a fix. That'd be great, wouldn't it? Not so good at that. Because if I could give you this thing, I could also take it away from you. And I'm just mean enough to do it if you didn't do it my way. Nobody can do these things for me but me. And there's nothing there that needs interpreting. Don't kid yourself. Thank God I got here too late to interpret. And by the time I could interpret, I didn't need to, because it was already sober. I haven't interpreted me yet. I don't care what Bill Wilson was thinking about when he wrote them, or what you think about it. I know what they mean to me. I know what they meant to me then, and I know what they mean to me now. That first of the notes says we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. That's what it meant to me 17 years ago. That's what it means to me tonight. Nothing more, nothing less. Just for a sideline, it never says in there any place that my life after 10 or 15 or 20 years is going to become manageable by me again. And I have looked. It's not in the book. And there's nothing in my experience that says it will. So let's get simple. Let's do the thing to the best of our ability one day at a time. And let the miracle happen. And it will. And we don't need a lot of other knowledge. The only knowledge we need is the nature of our problem. That's the only added knowledge we need. And the only ability we need is what we bring with us to our first meeting. And if we use it all, it's enough. Because what we lack is supply. It's just simple. Do it. And it will do it to you. Now we're going to stop and start over. But this one won't be as long as the other one. We're starting a new deal now. Often I say in finishing a talk, that the time must come with us when we can say to ourselves, if there be fault, it is mine. We got to be rid of the last excuse.
any alcoholic that has one excuse left that is still satisfactory to him or acceptable to him has another drunk left. Because nobody is going to fulfill these conditions as long as he can blame this on his mother-in-law. You know? And so we have to come to see that if there be fault, it is mine. And I say if there be fault, because I do not believe it's fault. I think we are the victim of the combination of characteristics with which we were born. Now, if there's anything that this program has shown me in the last 17 years, is that the first two words of the little prayer we're going to say after a while to close this meeting are correct, are true. Our Father. This program has proven this to me beyond any shadow of doubt. Our Father. And if God is our Father, we're his gift. And I am convinced that he's always known. But you and I have to find it out. Now, as our Father's kid, all of us have the characteristics that I'm just about to mention, to a degree. But only the alcoholic has them in the combination that you and I have. It's not that we or I have a corner on these things, but we are the people that have them in the combination that we have. And these characteristics have made it impossible for us to integrate ourselves into the life around us. I've known lots of alcoholics in this country, Canada, at the Roaring Islands. And I've never yet known an alcoholic that was a perfectionist, an idealist, regardless of background, race, creed, color, educational advantages or none. Every alcoholic I ever knew was a perfectionist, with a terrific drive to excel. You've heard all your life, this is the best mechanic we've ever had in the shop, but the best doctor's ever hit this part of the country, but best stenographer we ever had in the office, but you can't get down to the place until about of a Tuesday. Perfectionist with the terrific drive for excellence. Now this is both good and bad. It's good in that it won't let us settle for less than perfection. But it's bad in that it makes us demand perfection not only out of ourselves, but out of everything around us. Out of the people around us, out of life, out of society, out of everything. And this is real bad. Because people don't perform according to that pattern. And we've got to learn that someday and give them the right to their own mistakes. But we don't know this now. And we don't like the way they're doing things. And we can't integrate ourselves in it. Another one of these little things is the interior awareness of the alcoholic that life is good and big and beautiful. Every one of us has this, comes with it. It's a tremendous thing with us. Life is big and beautiful. It's like it is now. We knew this when we were kids. It ought to be like this. There's a couple of lines in a Wordsworth poem that says this better than I know how. Not in complete forgetfulness, nor yet in utter nakedness, but trailing clouds of glory did we come from heaven, which is our home. We've had this inside us forever. Life is a big, beautiful, and good thing, and we look at it and it's not. And the psychiatrists of the world tell us that we're emotionally immature. Every one of them. You can't read anything about it. They're emotionally immature. I don't believe it. We came in. We're a highly sensitive people. As you know, I can't hardly say this without laughing. This is kicker's beet plum tea. Because it can't be explained to nobody. Not even us. For instance, how many times have you cried yourself to sleep over a beautiful sunset when you're so drunk you couldn't even get up off the floor? It's so pretty we can't stand it, you know. How are you going to explain that to the normal mind? Can't be done. My good wife used to say to me, Chuck, if you loved me, you wouldn't do these things. How in the world could I tell her it was because I loved her that I did them? And the worst drunk I ever had is because I knew I was crucifying my wife and my kids. And it was killing me. And I couldn't stand it. And I got drunk and crucified them over again. You can't explain these things. A highly sensitive bunch of people. A bundle of emotions. And we get hurt so easy. You know, it's an amazing thing. I've talked in Folsom Prison before an audience begin there. Folsom Prison is pretty tough, maximum security. You can't even get in there for murder if it's the first time. In fact, you got to be an habitual to get in that joint. And I stood up here and looked into the eyes of 300 or 400 of those guys bawling right along with me. And it wasn't because they were emotionally immature. It was because of that tremendous identity. They felt just like I did. And they knew exactly what I felt. It's not emotional immaturity. It's just this great, tremendous emotional thing that comes with it. And so we get hurt. And everything in life hurts us. And we are not able to integrate ourselves into society. And we get hurt. And we start chipping things off. And we chip everything off. We chip off places and people and jobs and wives. Because we get hurt and we don't want to get hurt anymore. And we start building that wall around us and we start in with this self-thinking that eventually labels us as the most egotistical and the most selfish individuals that live. You know, self-thinking. And it's not because we want to think about ourselves. It's because we're a problem to ourselves and we don't know why. We can't fit, and we don't know why.
You know that woman of mine didn't know. But after she went to sleep, I laid there only that far away from her. Our beds were only 30 inches apart. And I'd lay there and cry. Then my pillow was wet clear through the mattress. Because I wanted to tell her, look, honey, I love her. I won't do this thing anymore. I couldn't tell her. I knew I'd do it again. And I might as well have been in Siberia. You see, people don't know these things, and we can't tell them. And we're trapped. And we don't know why. And we hurt, and we drink. And it's the only peace we've ever known. And this is the reason we beat her brains out for 10 years after we've lost. Because we remember the time when it was all right with us. And you were all right with us. And we had peace. We try to get back. We can't make it. We either get almost there and fall back, or we go through. But it's the only peace we've ever known. And we keep beating our brains out to get back. And finally, thank God, the bottle beats us to death. Beats us into total and absolute nothingness. And when there's nothing left to defend, it's easy to surrender. And we abandon ourselves. And we come to this simple program. And people tell us here are the steps we took. And we see them, and we feel them. And we know they're drunks because they're marked up like we are. And we know they're sober. And we see their eyes. And we know they got something that we'd give our last drop of blood to have. And they tell us, do these things. See what happens to you. And they share their experience, strength, and hope with us. And we do it. And something happens. And we don't have to drink anymore. Now the miracle that returned me from the land of the living dead proves two things that are just as clear to me as your faces. Number one, the power. If all the books on earth said this weren't true, I'd laugh. Because from the very moment of surrender until now, I have not taken another drink. Now, if there'd have been something for me to do, I couldn't have done it. If there'd have been a river to cross, I couldn't have crossed it. If there'd have been anything but the abandonment of self, I couldn't have done it. And so that was it. And in the abandonment of self, something happened. And I didn't have to drink anymore, and I didn't have to die. And doctors and priests and preachers who know my story have said that this surrender came in the very act of dying. And I have not drink anymore. So this miracle proves the power beyond any question of doubt for me.
And it also proves the eternality of life. Somebody might say, well, how does it prove the eternality of life? Because I cannot conceive why any power would have brought me back from the land of the living dead into the land of the living just to die tonight. It's inconceivable. And so I know that life is real, life is earnest, and the grave is not its goal. That it is eternal as God himself is eternal. And so you see, that's why I told you a while ago that there's been no fear of life or death. The things present are things to come. Since I woke up to the fact that this thing had happened. Now, I have gotten this sense. I am convinced that there's only one problem in life. That includes all problems. And one answer that includes all answers, all of them. All fear, all frustration, all disease, all disease, all insecurity is caused by only one thing. The feeling of conscious separation from the thing that says to me I'm different from and other than you, that I have to outthink you, outperform you, and outmaneuver in order to eke out a miserable living out of an unfriendly universe. The feeling of conscious separation from life, good, God. Now, I'm convinced this is the best definition of the ego you and I will ever hear. This is the ego. This is the thing that sets me apart. This is the thing that made me walk alone for 43 years. The feeling of conscious separation from. In other words, I thought that was my definition for a long time. Shortly after I found this way of life, maybe it's the first 3 years, I was talking to a men's club in church one night, and I'd given the privilege of questions. And I got done finally. And I asked for a question, and the first guy got up and said, you've talked a lot about human ego, what is it? And I said, well, you silly ass, anybody know, why don't you ask a sensible, I don't know. And I said, let's look at it and see if we can find out. And we got to playing with it, and this thing came up. The feeling of conscious separation from life, good, God. And I said, that's it. It's the best definition we ever hear. And I thought it was mine, so I went home, woke up my wife, and I said, honey, listen to this. Isn't this terrific? I got it. And it's mine. And for the next 6 months, I told everybody that listened to me about my definition of the ego. And I was reading a little book about that thick called The Divine Life by Sri Aurobindo at that time. I don't advise you to read it. Fine print, no pictures in it. And you get started up here, and by the time you get here, you don't know where you started. But I was just reading it for fun. I'd already found myself. And I was about two-thirds of the way through it, and one night I started cackling like an old hen that laid a square egg, and my wife says, what now, little one? And I said, listen to my definition of the ego. And I read it to her, the feeling of conscious separation from, and it's 10,000 years older than Jesus.
and I thought it was mine.
Now this is the problem, and the answer is just the reverse. The feeling of conscious unity with, living in, a part of, this great thing called life with God. In Him we live and move and have our being. And the conscious awareness of this is the answer and the only answer. One, the feeling of conscious separation, and the other, the feeling of conscious unity. And how is this thing going to come about? This feeling of conscious separation has to go over the board. And this is the great, this feeling of conscious separation has to go over the board. And this is the great value in surrender. When we abandon ourselves completely, that thing is temporarily gone. The ego is gone, temporarily. And without the ego, we don't need its children. And what are its children? Self-pity. Resentment. Judgment. Lies, deceit. All of these things we peel off like peeling the banana. By the practice of these principles in all of our faith. And we get rid of them. And we uncover the thing that we've been searching for forever. We uncover the thing. We find ourselves and each other and our very own God. You know, there was a Catholic priest in Germany a few hundred years ago. He was Dominican. He said, "You have heard that nature abhors a vacuum. I tell you that God abhors a vacuum. Can't abide a vacuum any place under heaven, however small." Now he says, "All you got to do is move out. Get empty of self, and automatically you're full of God." That's what we're talking about, the surrender. To get out of our own way. And automatically, there it is. There was another Catholic. I don't happen to be Catholic. But I love them. I've gotten much from many other people. And this guy was a long time ago too, 1066. And his name was Brother Lawrence. And he says, if you would find God, look deep within yourself, because it's the only place you're ever going to find Him. And for the likes of you and me, we got some cleanup work to do before we can look deep within ourselves. We got some windows to wash. And we do it by these 12 steps. The first 9 steps of this program cleans us up, gets rid of the wreckage of the past, washes the windows, and then we can look deep within ourselves and find the thing that was all we've always been looking for. And we finally come to see that the thing we've been looking for, we've been looking with for a lifetime. It's so close we can't find it. And why is this so strange to us? The good book says God is life. I love the New Testament account of creation. So simple and pretty. It says in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and without the Word was not anything made that was made.
And the Word became flesh and dwelt amongst us. And God became people and dwelt amongst us. God is people. Terrific. And so we uncover the thing we've been looking for forever. And we discover ourselves. And we discover the truth of our being, that we are our Father's children. And it includes our relationship one to another and to Him. It's the most fabulous thing under heaven. Terrific. I don't think it's so much something added as it is something uncovered. And again, I don't see why it's hard for us to see. I can't see how it's so hard for us to see. You know, there's a little story, and they asked me to close this thing with it. That to me is just as graphic. It's my life and it's your life. And it shows me and it shows me you and our relationship to each other and to our God. And it's so wonderful. We heard a little of it this afternoon, but mainly about the other brother. And I take a little license with this thing, but I've got to use it in order to get myself out of this mess. I got in. And it's so terrific. This is the story of the prodigal son. And again, it's my story. I've known this thing since I was knee high to a duck. But I never knew what it meant until quite a long time after. So, because it was about somebody else. And it's just like this program of ours. As long as we read the good book about somebody else and their relationship, it don't mean much. But when we're on the page, just like the Alcoholics Anonymous book, it means an awful lot. And this, again, is my story. And this is what it means to me, for what it's worth. It says that there's a certain wealthy man, God, had two sons, you and I. And the youngest one up came to his father and he says, "Look, Dad, I've got a lot of ideas. I got a lot of dreams. I'm going out to California and cut myself a big swath out there. Give me my inheritance." Now the father didn't say to him, "Wait a minute, big boy. We're wealthy. Stay home. Stay here. We got everything in the world that you might need. Stay home. You might get out there and get into trouble. Away from home. You might even run into a blonde with a bottle of muscadoodle and get into a lot of trouble. Stay here." No, he didn't argue with him at all. The kid says, "Give me my inheritance," and he gave it to him. And the kid went into a far country, away from home, away from God, consciously separated from. The kid went into the far country and wasted his substance on riotous living. Now that might not mean you to you, but it means me to me. That's suspiciously like what I did. And he wasted his substance on riotous living, and after he'd spent all, there arose a mighty famine in the land. And the kid came to want. Now if there's any people that ought to understand a famine, We ought to understand.
I don't think they make famines like that no more.
And the kid came to want. So what'd he do? Come back home?
No.
He did just like you did and just like I did.
He went to a man in that country. We went to the doctor and the lawyer and, you know, psychiatrist. And to Timbuktu.
Around the world a few times.
He went to a man in that country. And the man fixed him up temporarily. He gave him a job. And of all things that he might have put him to doing, he didn't. He put him to tending the pigs. Now this is most significant. Because this was a Jew boy telling this story, and they don't like pigs. No time. No how. There is nothing that is any worse than tending a pig for a Jew. And he is telling us that the boy was down. He was way down. We got a name for it in AA. We call it a low bottom. And so there he was, tending the pig. And while he was in the pig pen, he got hungry. And he fain would eat the husks that the pigs did eat. And no man gave unto him. This is terrific. He was beyond human power. I've been in that pig pen. We've got a line in our book that sort of matches that. No human power could have relieved the offering. And no man gave unto him. Same thing. And while he was in there, the kid says to himself, first, the line that brings it out is so good. The kid came to himself. This is true. Now I remember that morning in January, 17 years ago, when I woke up with a little period of sanity and could see myself with nothing between me and me. And my life changed that morning. The kid came to himself and he took a look at himself and he says, I've lost. I've lost the battle of life. I'm no good. I'm a sinner. I'm a bad boy. I've flunked out. And while he was thinking this way, he remembered that in his father's house was plenty to spare. But again, just even as you and I, he said to himself, now I can't go back home and say, look, here's your boy. I'm your son, don't you remember? Take me back here. He couldn't do that. Because he wasn't worthy, even as you and I. But he remembered that the servants there had more than he did. And he said to himself, I'm not fit to go back and ask to be put on as a son, but I'll go back and ask to be put on as a hired servant. And he made a decision. He says, I will arise and go to my father. And we have a line like that, too. It says, we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to God. Same thing. He says, I will arise and go to my father. And so he started to go back home. And here's the miracle of AA. In my book, here's the miracle. The father saw him a long ways off and came to meet him. And the father saw me a long ways off and came to meet me.
through you who had already found your way. this is the miracle. And when the kid saw him, he said to him, "I'm a bad boy. I'm no good. I'm a sinner." But again, the father didn't argue with him. He didn't say, "Yeah, I know how bad you are. I've got the books on you right here. You sure are a stinker. Now get the grubbing hoe and get back here on the back 40 and get to work on those persimmon sprouts and sassafras bushes. And if you do a pretty good job, maybe 25 years from now, I'll invite you in to have lunch." No. Again, there was no argument. The father didn't even hear it. He fell on his neck and kissed him. And he put a ring on his finger, the symbol of eternal life, no beginning and no end. And he called to the servant. And he says, "Kill the fatted calf. We're going to have a party." The boy was dead and he's now alive. He was lost. And he's come back home. Let's celebrate. And we have a line for that too. That God could and would, if so. This is true. This is my story. This is my experience on the way down and on the way back. It's not normal for you and I to walk alone, consciously separated from each other and from life itself and God, the Father of life. It's normal to become like little children, in complete dependence on this great thing and each other. This is normal. It's normal for us to share our experience, strength, and hope one with another in love, helping each other over the hurdles of life. This is normal. It's not normal to be away from the Father's house. Not normal to walk alone. You know, I think you and I are the most fortunate people to live. I don't believe that any segment of the human race is as fortunate as we. Because, you see, we did this thing backwards as long as we could. I'd still be out there if I could have lived. But in the very accident of failure, I found the thing I'd been searching for forever. That. And I wasn't even looking for it. I came here with all the problems you can come with, but I wasn't looking for answers for them. I was just looking for a way to live that didn't include that split. And I would have settled for the meanest old unhappy sobriety on earth. Just as long as I didn't have to drink anymore, I'd had it. And they says, "Here are the steps we took." And I saw it and felt it and did it and found it and have had it for 17 years. The answer to the disease of alcoholism and the answer to the riddle of life, because alcoholism is a living problem and we have to have a living problem. The answer to our disease and the answer to life itself is one and the same answer. And it's nothing in the world but a consciously acceptable personal partnership with the living God that made it in the total business of living. That's the only answer there is.
conscious unity with, living in, a part of. In Him we live and move and have our being. Don't be afraid of this thing. Don't be afraid of it. There is sobriety here, and for the likes of me, it's the best thing that there is. It's the best gift that any God could give me. Because I can't live and drink, and of myself I can't keep from drinking. Yes, there is sobriety here, but there is something else. There's the AA way of life, than which there is nothing finer under heaven. A fabulous life. My own experience, I haven't had to have a drink for over 17 years. My family life was put back together. I got a new body out of the deed. My business life was put back together. My social life. My entire life. And for 17 years, it's gotten better with the months and with the years. And I didn't do it. I couldn't do it. At the ripe old age of 43, a failure in every department of life. Failure as a husband, a father, a businessman, man, and drunk. I did that. And I take the credit. But for these past 17 years, no. This I could not do. This, by the grace of God, through people like you. And it's fabulous. And I have come to love you so much. You know how long it's been since I saw a drunk? 10 years. 10 years. And yet I go from my office downtown, I invariably go the full length of Skid Row. But I never see a wino or a drunk. I see me, but with the grace of God. And I can't hardly pass them by. That's me, but with the grace of God. And so again and again and again. I love this thing and I love you so much that I hope I live 1,000 years just so I can walk down the road with you. And when I get out of one of these things, there's something within me that must correspond to the disciples. You remember when Jesus joined them as they walked down the road? And then disappeared. And after he was gone, they said to each other, didn't our hearts burn within us when he walked with us and talked with us to the wayside? Oh, how I love to talk with you and walk with you along this way. When we can, without fear or favor, say to each other, but by the grace of God. I got a little prayer from half a dozen sources of Christmas. And I love it so much, and I close with it. A little Gaelic thing. It says, may your road rise with you. May the wind be always at your back. May the good Lord hold you in the hollow of his hand. God bless you all. Thank you very much.